Water in your engine can cause irreversible damage in your vehicle. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Here to talk about how to avoid water damage is Jim Ward. He's the service manager at Smart Motors, and he has over 10 years of master certification. Jim stops by every other month to help you out with your vehicle. So what questions do you have about water damage in your car or other vehicle problems? We're here to help. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hey, Jim. It's nice to have you back with us. Before we get to the phones, let's talk a little bit about this water. What does the water actually do to an engine?
Well, it depends on the circumstances when the water gets in.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes if the engine's running and water gets in, it's pretty disastrous immediately. Water doesn't compress like the air or fuel mixture that an engine's used to burning. And so it's like you have cement in there. Basically, it does significant major engine damage if what happens is what's called hydrolocking. But it can bend valves, it can break pistons, and those are in the heart of the motor. It often will result in having to replace the motor. It can blow a hole right through the block of the motor. However, if the car isn't running and the car just sits and the water ingresses where the car is, it can still get a high enough level of water to run into the motor. But if you don't attempt to start that engine and you get the spark plugs out and get the water out before you can get it all out of the intake, you can actually prevent the damage from happening. And then you may not have any problem. But unfortunately, people often don't realize that. They go to try to start it, and right then it'll destroy the motor, the same as if you'd driven it into the water running.
Because you're bringing it into the engine is what's happening.
Right.
Okay. So how much water does it take to cause damage?
Very little.
Very little.
An engine, 1 to 2 tablespoons can be enough. Just an ounce or two can do it, because it only has to get into one cylinder, and the displacement of a given cylinder is not really great on most engines. It's not a huge amount, and the air intake for the engine typically is somewhere right behind the driver's headlight area. And the water doesn't have to get that high. Standing water doesn't have to get that high. You can get the unlucky splash of water. That air intake is like the end of that. The suction there is like a vacuum cleaner. So, when the engine's running, if you're to put your hand over it, you're going to feel a strong suction. And if you leave the hand there very long, the engine's going to quit running because it's got to have the air pulling in to run. But so water just flying by there at the wrong moment can get sucked in and can do it. Now, you may watch one car after another drive through water and not have that happen and just be the unlucky one, but that's how it works. It can be barely random in smaller amounts of water. The deeper the water, obviously, the greater the risk and the chance.
So talking about deep water, what advice do you have if we're, like we have in the last year, we've run into water on roads? When should you stop? And, how do you know when it's safe to just keep going?
Well, if it's moving water, you should always stop.
Okay.
The National Weather Service has got a phrase, turn around, don't drown. And it's really important to observe that because this may be a familiar route to you. And you come to a little culvert-type bridge and see running water over it. You see the water running under it and think, it could only be a couple of inches deep on this bridge. You don't know that there's still a road under it there. That's part of the problem. Standing water might be a little bit different, but still, the water ran in there at some point. It was moving at some point. You don't necessarily know what's happened to the pavement underneath that water. Things get displaced. Manhole covers get pushed out. A lot of different things can get washed into the road that you can't see. So you could damage tires. You could have all kinds of things happen to the underside of your car, thinking that this is just water in the road and it's a little bit, a foot deep. And, what could happen? Well, bad things can happen. And the thing is, probably the majority of the time, bad things don't happen. You can watch somebody else drive through it and not have a problem. That doesn't mean you won't. But certainly if it's moving water, be safe. Don't try to drive through moving water. And if it's standing water, I don't know that I would risk it. You might watch someone else go through it. And if it's really just a few inches deep, you might risk it. But that doesn't somebody else getting through doesn't guarantee you will.
Does it also depend on how high your car is?
It does, but when it comes to moving water, that's not really the case because, again, since you don't necessarily know what the roadway underneath there is like, if the water's moving, it doesn't 6 to 12 inches of water will wash away most vehicles. Mm-hmm. Cars, you know, closer to 6 inches, if you get closer to a foot, even big trucks, the force of the water can wash your vehicle off the road if it's moving water. If it's standing water, obviously height makes a big difference. The higher the vehicle, the more clearance and the more room you have for water to splash up and not necessarily be as close to that intake. But there's an element of luck. You know, if you are doing it, you want to go slow, you know, really slow and carefully. But it's still, there's always a risk.
Okay. And once your car does get water in it, maybe it's still running, but it's got wet carpet. And what should you do at that point?
Well, the carpet, if you get water into the interior, you want to get it all out as quickly as possible. The initial thought might be, well, I'm just going to go someplace that's got a wet vac, a shop vac, and I'm just going to suck this right up through the carpet. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the carpet's not – on most cars, the carpet's not right up against the floorboard of the car. There's carpeting. There's a pad underneath it. Often there's some very stiff styrofoam spacers that may be a couple of inches to 2-3 inches thick that have channels in them for wiring harnesses to run through. So your feet on the carpet is not necessarily on the floor of the car. So you may suck up all the water you can out of the carpet, but there may be inches of water underneath that aren't going to get pulled up out of there. So the right procedure is you remove the seats, you remove the carpeting, you remove the pads, you remove those styrofoam forms that are underneath there completely. There are then drains, little rubber drains in the floorboards of the car. You take those rubber drains out, get all the water you can out, get it completely dried, and then you need to be proactive about mold. And there's different products out there. Concorbium is the one that we as a shop use. It's sodium carbonate, sodium bicarbonate, and I don't think sodium tricarbonate is quite the right name, but that's how they call it. But it's like a triple salt that will kill the mold spores that are there and help prevent future mold. And you have to be really aggressive with that. So we soak the floorboard down with it. We soak all the carpets and all the pads. In our shop, from our experience last year, like when you go to a car wash, they've got the clips on the wall to put your floor mats on to clean them. We have one long wall where we just lined it with those things because we had to hang up carpeting out of one car after another, uh-huh, after another, after another, and all the pads, and try to dry it out. And even then, sometimes, you know, if you don't do it quick enough and the mold gets started, it's even if you use a mold abatement, you may get behind, you may never get the smell out. You know, ultimately, a lot of cars that got totaled last year didn't necessarily have engine failures. I mean, the ones that did have engine failures were more likely to be totaled, but they can be, even though the engine was fine, if you get enough wiring damage and enough carpet and seat damage, it can be enough to total a car out.
So that's really something that a professional should be doing?
It really is. Okay. It really is. I mean, you're, for one thing, the carpeting that runs under the floorboard is often the airbag and supplementary restraint system wiring. And, you know, if you're ever going to try that yourself, disconnect the battery and leave it disconnected for a couple of minutes before you even start, because there are wire connectors that go up into the seats, you know, for power seats, and there are airbags in seats. Most cars, your side airbags come out of your outside seat bolster. So this is typically not a do-it-yourself kind of thing. You often need some special equipment, some special chemicals, and just the knowledge of the wiring and everything to get to that floorboard as quickly as possible and get things really dried out and the mold abatement on everything. And yeah.
So do it right.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Randy from West Dallas waiting. Hi, Randy. What's your question?
I have a 2001 Cadillac Eldorado ETC, and I am experiencing overheating consistently, even on short rides. And this problem's been going on for about a year. The engine's got 100. It's the problem started at 140,000 miles, and I have 147 currently miles. I've replaced the water pump, the radiator, and cleaned out the purge line, which feeds to the water reservoir. I'm wondering if you have any other suggestions.
So one of the things that comes to mind is that the fan that is supposed to blow air through the radiator when the car is not moving along is an electric fan. And if that electric fan doesn't work, you may be fine while you're moving at a fairly good speed. But if you are in town at lower speeds or at stoplights, an engine would tend to overheat under those circumstances if that fan wasn't working. So are you able to link the overheating to low speed or idling or stops, or will it do it when you're driving down the highway as well?
All those conditions. And as far as the fan, we've confirmed that the fan does turn on even before the temperature gauge indicates overheating. I expect that the fan runs intermittently as needed, and there's a sensor. My next step would be to possibly replace the sensor on that fan. Perhaps it's not performing as it should, and the cost of a sensor is probably cheap. What do you think?
Well, if the fan comes on before you see the overheat, I mean, it may be that the sensor, but usually those are go, no go. They can get out of range, but the fan is coming on. And once the fan is on, it should have the ability to cool the engine down if everything else is as it should be. It does not sound like everything else is as it should be. You know, some of the one of the steps I would want to see done is a pressure test on that cooling system. You can, some cooling systems are easier than others. I don't know that vehicle has a cap right on the radiator. I think it goes to the reservoir. But basically, you pressurize the cooling system up to, fairly not high pressure like when they're overheating, not 25 to 30 foot pounds per square inch, but you want to pressurize it fairly high operating pressures. And then there are a number of, obviously you're watching at that point, once you have it under pressure, you're watching for external leaks, but then you also want to pull spark plugs and use something like a borescope to look in the cylinders. It's possible that you might have a head gasket that is pushing hydrocarbons, exhaust gases, into the coolant. And that pressure test just helps you narrow down if something is going on. But it sounds like you don't tend to have a loss of coolant. You don't have to add antifreeze. It's not like you have a leak somewhere.
I do have to add water constantly, even on short trips. A couple of short trips, I will be low on water, sometimes up to a gallon. So I did utilize the carbon, I believe it's carbon monoxide test, the little disc in the radiator, and that color change indicated there was no carbon monoxide. That kind of ruled out the head gasket.
Right. Well, it doesn't necessarily, though. Those are okay, but they don't always work 100% accurately. I would still, especially given the fact that you're having to add antifreeze, I would run that pressure test. You need to get it under pressure and observe it. And, I mean, typically engines may not always – an engine that has a coolant leak like that may not leak continuously and all the time. It may only leak at times when the engine's cooler or when the engine's hotter. So I would want to do the pressure test once with the cold engine. I'd want to warm the engine up and then do the pressure test again. And again, look at all the external possibilities for leakage, but then also pull the plugs and use a borescope as a device where you can just stick a little tube down in and see kind of on a screen, see the inside of the cylinders, which you can't really just look in with your naked eye, and see if there's signs of coolant getting inside the motor like that. Because it can be one way or another. You would think that typically with a head gasket leak, you'd think, well, if there's hydrocarbons getting pushed into the coolant, then coolant must be getting into the cylinders and vice versa, but that's not always the case. It can be one way or the other or both, but the fact that you're losing coolant implies that a leak is the problem, and we need to find where that leak is coming from.
Okay, thank you very much for the call, Randy. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Dave Potras is our technical director today, and Jane Rotunda is our on-air producer. We're talking vehicle maintenance today. Jim Ward is our guest. He's service manager at Smart Motors. He's back with us to answer your questions. Do you have one? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we do have a couple of lines open, but we have got Mike waiting, and he's in New Glarus. Hi, Mike. What's your question?
Yeah, hi. Say, I just wanted to agree with what he said about the carpeting holding moisture and not letting it up. And just I had a sunroof that leaked here a while ago. Actually, it's been a couple months ago. And as I took the carpeting out, and then basically all last week it was outside in the sun drying. We had a really nice week last week for drying. And that foam in the back of the carpeting will just hold the moisture, and even sucking it out with a shop vac, it still takes a long time for that to dry out. So, if you don't get that dried out, it will eventually rust through the floor.
Right. And, yeah, it is amazing. It used to be that the carpet backing and the padding underneath were made of jute, which didn't hold water as much. Now they're made out of a foam that it absolutely right. A week is not an unusual time frame at all. If you can, out in the sun is okay. We're blessed. We have an air-conditioned shop. So, we've got clips and put them up on the wall like floor mats in a car wash and put fans on them. But, yep, it does take a long time. It's not something that's going to dry in an afternoon or a couple of days.
Okay. Well, thanks for that comment, Mike. Appreciate that. We did get an email from Kate, and she's always wondered how various vehicles used for off-roading or, you know, safari-type trips can drive through seemingly deep running water and survive. Are they different than regular passenger vehicles?
They're different, and vehicles can be modified. Every now and then, you're going to see a vehicle. Usually, it's going to be an SUV, and it's usually going to be an SUV that's been raised, lifted. And what you're going to see is that along the pillar, the windshield pillar, either on the driver's side or on the passenger side, you're going to see this tube sticking up, this weird black plastic tube that sticks up all the way to the roof. That's the air intake for that vehicle. They've modified the air intake so that it won't pull water in, you know, right behind the driver's headlight or down low where they typically would. And, you know, I've got a niece who's into off-roading. She's got a SUV, and, you know, I wasn't sure how serious she was. We don't live by each other, so I look at pictures of her vehicle over time as she's customized it. And one day, sure enough, that's called a snorkel, by the way.
And
sure enough, she's got a snorkel on her SUV. So, there are definitely customizations that allow them to do that without running into trouble.
Okay. Yeah. Jim, why don't they do that on regular cars?
Would you like to have a snorkel on your car? On
that,
you
know, it's better than getting water in my engine.
You know, there's so many things that you might do to all cars, but when you do mass production, this is not something that happens to most cars. Mm-hmm. You know, so cars are not built for the exception. You know, generally they're built for the rules. Now, some safety systems are built for all kinds of exceptions, but this is just. This has not been a common scenario. You know, if it becomes more so, you might start seeing that there's modifications and they completely change the intakes on vehicles.
Okay. So that is something you can add, but usually SUV, not necessarily passenger car? Or?
I can't think of a passenger car I've seen that have had it, although I've seen people will customize anything.
Yeah, and,
you know,
that's
you
true.
See, you see passenger cars sometimes that have like an old, you know, 80s or 90s sedan that's been put on a 4x4 frame and is way up there. So the rules kind of go out the window.
Sure.
When you start customizing cars, people do what they want to do with just about any platform.
Sure. Okay. Well, great. Let's go back to the phones. We have Chris in River Falls. He's got a question. Hey, Chris.
Yeah. Say, I just, I that last call about the Cadillac. I own a Cadillac ETC, same motor. It's a 97. The thing is I do know that they have problems. They have aluminum inserts on the head gaskets, so the bolts work loose, and that will cause the problem that man is having. The deal is it can be fixed. It's about a $3,000 fix. They got to pull them bolts out, drill out the aluminum inserts, put steel inserts in, and they can tighten down, and you won't have that problem anymore. It's very common in those North Stars.
Sure. Yep. And that pressure test usually catches that. Yep. The helicoil where the threads strip for the cylinder head bolts. And, you know, usually it's got more obvious symptoms of a head gasket than what he's describing, but that may very well be it, because that wasn't an uncommon problem on those Cadillac engines.
Okay. Thanks for that comment, Chris. Next up, we have Greg, and he is in Madison. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Jim. I have a question about replacing a timing belt on a 05 Lexus, and I'm pretty sure I know what your answer is going to be, but I'm going to ask the question anyways. It's only got 50,000 miles on it, and I believe you're supposed to replace the timing belt every, I don't know, 9 or 10 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first. And, you know, I'm at 50,000 miles or just a hair over that, and it's 14 years old. So it runs great, and I think I'm running the risk of because it's an interference engine. And so, like I said, I know what you're going to say is just replace it, but I don't want to do that.
You know, it's Toyota, well, all manufacturers have some engines. Most engines that are interference have changed, but not all of them. And if it's got a belt and it's an interference engine, then you know what the consequences are if that belt even jumps a tooth. You know, it sounds like you know a little bit about timing belts. I mean, a lot of people think of just one of the drive belts under the hood that's just a friction fit, but a timing belt's more like a bicycle chain in that it's got to keep things timed and synchronized perfectly. And the other thing is that the timing belt is not just out in the weather exposed like an alternator or a power steering belt. It is under a cover. It is more protected. Yet at the same time, you know, if it's an interference engine, my recommendation is going to be you change it by the time or mileage, whichever comes first recommendation, just like the manufacturer, which I think is going to be 6 years, 90,000 miles on that Lexus. It's just not worth the risk. I mean, the belt doesn't necessarily have to shred. All that has to happen is one tooth has to, because it is a gear cog. It has like little tooth ridges on it, little gear ridges on it. And one of those fails and the belt can slip. And at that point, the results are very similar to what happens when you get a hydrolic and get water in the engine. It's catastrophic and can bend valves. So particularly on interference engines, it's not worth it. You know, and depending on what your luck is, I don't have good luck on things like this. But if it's not an interference engine, if the belt does fail, the engine's just going to quit and you're going to have it towed somewhere and have it fixed then. But that's going to happen on a day that I'm dressed and ready to go to a wedding for me. I mean, that's when it's going to happen for me. So, you know, if you've got good luck but yeah, with an interference engine, I wouldn't chance it.
Is it dangerous?
Well, it's in as much as any breakdown of a car can be dangerous. Imagine the Beltline rush hour. You know, you suddenly have lost power and you're in a middle lane and, you know, depending on where you are, there may be two or three lanes on either side of you. That's dangerous. You know, other circumstances it might fail might not be nearly as dangerous, but it can be.
Okay, great. Thanks, Don. Or Greg, sorry about that. Let's go next to Nick, and Nick is in Milwaukee. Hi, Nick.
I'm going to really challenge your knowledge here. I've got a 2016 Vulcan, Kawasaki Vulcan motorcycle, and it's after I stored it for a year, it seemed to backfire itself, so I put a can of sea foam there. It rained really good for a while, and then last week, of course, I'm going to work, and I got to a red light, and I tried to go, and it was clogged or something, so I put another can of seafoam in there, and it's running, but it's backfiring. And any suggestions?
My suggestion is going to be to take that one to a motorcycle shop. I'm trying to think of what year it was. The last motorcycle I had was, I was 12. Motorcycles are a little bit different animal than vehicles. Not my area of expertise. I'm just going to put that right out there. Something I would not be able to give you advice on.
So, Nick, find another source, and thanks for calling in. Next up, we've got Duke, and he is in North Prairie. What can we help you with, Duke?
Good morning. We recently kind of inherited Grandma's car. She's still alive, but she can't drive anymore. She lives in Arizona. So my wife went out and brought the car back. It's a Toyota Corolla, a 2010, and it only has 30,000 miles on it. The advice from people there was that when you get it home, you want to think about everything rubber on the car, because the extreme heat there can really deteriorate anything that's rubber. Mm-hmm. So I haven't done anything yet, but of course, a couple weeks into using the car through a code, at service engine light, and the codes were about the evaporative emissions system. Mm-hmm. And it seems to run just fine. It's not doing anything. I had that happen one time and I couldn't fill the gas tank because it would keep shutting off. Not doing that either. But the codes are there. And it also, the part of the fix for the codes was check your gas cap. So I got a new gas cap and put it on and screwed it in tight. And codes were gone. We cleared the codes. Codes were gone for a few days and now they're back. And I just wondered if you have any advice on how to get down to the nitty gritty on this, because I was through it once before and it just got messy. And I wanted to know how to proceed to investigate and fix
sure.
the thing.
Sure. Well, the codes that you get are what tell us how to proceed. So some codes for the evaporative emission system will be leak codes, that you either have a small leak or you have a gross leak, and other codes will be that you have a flow problem. So what this system is it's the system that contains the vapors over the fuel in the fuel tank, and it doesn't just contain them. Those vapors are actually captured in a canister, and there are hoses that go up to the vehicle's intake where the air and fuel are brought into the engine, and that's part of what your engine runs on. It's very marginal in terms of how much it helps the vehicle run, but the point is that they're not being released into the atmosphere because they are a pollutant. And so one problem you can have is a leak and a gas cap that's got some corrosion on it, or if you don't tighten the gas cap properly when you get gas, that can be a source of it. Any of those hoses or containment systems, fuel filler necks sometimes can be the problem. That I'm trying to think of the 10 Corolla had a redesigned filler neck for an issue that they had. But there are also valves, because the flow isn't constant. It isn't like that these vapors constantly flow. They're contained, and there's valves that back by the tank, and there's a valve up by the engine that are purge and flow valves. So depending on the code you have, if it is a leak, then there are systems that's like a little fogger. There's a little smoker or fogger that we hook up to the system, and we fill it with that fog or smoke and watch for where it comes out. And that's the way that we find the leaks. The flow system comes more down to manual testing. If it says that a valve isn't working and isn't flowing, you may have a stuck valve, and that comes to testing those valves to see if they open and close when they're supposed to. If a valve is stuck, it's often because it's got something in it, and the something that it often gets in it is the charcoal desiccant that's supposed to be in the canister that stores those. So it can be real frustrating to put a valve in it that was found to be stuck, and then 2 weeks later, that same valve is found to be stuck. So, you know, if that's happening to a valve, you also want to check the lines and see if there is the charcoal canister is about the size of a football, and on each end, it's got a kind of a fabric or a medium that's supposed to keep the desiccant in and let the vapors through, and those sometimes will fail, and that desiccant gets out and starts plugging things up. So again, just depending on whether your codes indicate a leak or a flow problem, that's going to indicate which kind of testing you need to do.
Okay. Thank you very much, Duke. Next, we've got Don, and he's in Madison. Hi, Don.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks. What's your question?
Yeah. My son has a 2016 Mazda 3 with about 30,000 miles on it, and it's making a rumbling noise coming from the rear end when you go over bumps, but it's not consistent. Sometimes it does it quite thick, violently with a small bump, and you hit a large bump and it does nothing. He took it to a dealer. They said rear shocks. We were skeptical. He took it to a local independent repair shop. They said rear shocks, and they replaced them, and the noise is still there. So I was wondering if you had an idea what it might be.
Well, you may very well have had some leakage from the rear shocks. The shocks, the two evaluations are to look and see if the hydraulic fluid is starting to seep out, and then to just joust the car and see how, you know, each corner of the suspension responds and whether it's soft or not. But typically when I'm looking for something like this, we get the car up in the air, and there's different methods that we can use. You know, one of them is just trying to duplicate the condition, taking a dead blow hammer, which is like a big plastic coated, very large hammer, and smacking up on the tire from underneath and trying to see if you can duplicate the sound and kind of listening for where it comes from. Sometimes we have to get more sophisticated. Sometimes you can't duplicate it like that. We get under the car with a hammer like that and pry bars and check for free play on the various control arm linkages and such, and check for the bushings on those, and they'll have a sway bar that's got links that any of that can be loose and can make a noise. But usually those kind of noises are fairly consistent on bumps. But sometimes none of that hoist inspection will reveal what's going on. We take it a step further, and there are what are called electronic chassis ears, where you've got little alligator clips that sometimes are wired. The newer ones are wireless, where you clip them on different parts of the suspension, drive the car, and you have them clipped at different points that you might suspect might be making the noise, and you can change channels from one clip to another and find out where the noise is the loudest, and it helps you narrow down where it's coming from. So it's going to be either the manual inspection on a lift or using chassis ears or something to narrow down where this is coming from.
Okay, thank you very much, Don. Karen is next, and she's in Third Lake, Illinois. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you there? Karen? Oh, I guess Karen is not available at the point. Sorry about that. If you've got a question or a comment, you can give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's try Karen again. Are you here, Karen? Well, we've got a problem with Karen's call. I'm sorry, Karen. Maybe we need to have you hang up and call back, and hopefully we'll get you back in. So let's go to Leonard, and he's in Chicago. Hi, Leonard.
How are you today?
Well, thank you. What can we help you with?
Yes, I have a 2003 BMW Z4, and it's only had like 40,000 miles on it, and it started to have it. The battery went down, and I put a new battery in it, and now it has irregular idling, what kind of they call it, I think, and it's like does not respond to a gas. You can move if you switch the gear. It's a stick shift. It does not, you can get speed up or anything. It just does not respond to a gas, but it's idling like not on the same. It's like irregular. It goes like on and off, on and off, on and off, like you were pushing the gas.
Sure, sure. We call it hunting for idle when it's up and down and up and down. How long ago did you replace the battery?
Just did it, and it started it like that.
So if this is like within a day or so, often engines have a computer that controls the fuel injection system, and the idle actually in that computer is a learned value. And so if a battery goes dead, that computer can lose that learned value. And often it is as simple as just manually keeping that throttle open. And for a period of time, it may take 10, 15 minutes to keep the engine idling up in the range of like 1,000 RPM. And the computer can through that experience, it can relearn the idle that it's supposed to have. I mean, if this had not been right after a battery replacement, you could have varnish buildup in like an idle air control valve or on a throttle plate. But if this is right after a battery replacement, this is not a really uncommon scenario. We see it quite often, and it does have to do with that learned idle value that the computer's got to relearn, and it's kind of a manual thing you have to do is just keep the engine RPM up high enough so that you're above the range where it's going to hunt and go up and down like it is, and in 10 to 15 minutes it should relearn the idle value, and that is often all it takes to resolve that.
Okay, good luck, Leonard. Mark is next. He's calling from Coldgate. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. What's your question?
I have a 2010 Toyota Prius. I love it. It's a great car. Unfortunately, it's got high miles, 150,000. I blew a head gasket on it, and I have antifreeze leaking into the valves.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told I'm going to need either a new head gasket or a new engine. And I looked at the pricing of both of them, and they're about the same. And I guess I'm curious, just what is the best option? The body's in great shape. The hybrid system works wonderfully. Do you think going through and doing the head gasket repair and getting the valves reground, or just get a whole new engine?
We don't recommend the head gasket route. That's not true of all vehicles by any means. I mean, head gasket replacements is one of the first things I ever remember helping my dad with on an old Oldsmobile. And I mean, for decades and decades, when a head gasket's failed, we just replace a head gasket. But that engine, there are a few different things here that you have to be concerned about. Some engines have enough built-in clearance with the head and the block that an engine losing coolant, overheating, can have the block or the head milled and have some material taken off. That's not true of this Prius. There's nothing, no extra material to work with there. And they're also, that engine is very sensitive. Antifreeze is supposed to stay in the antifreeze system and is not supposed to be in the combustion system. And when it does get in there, the corrosion can also often do damage to the cylinder walls and to the rings, and it so unfortunately with that particular engine, when we have head gasket failure, we are not recommending head gasket replacement. We recommend engine replacements. There are just too many various things that can go wrong with that engine after a head gasket failure that simply replacing the head gasket most often does not resolve all of them. So you may end up having oil consumption afterwards, even if you successfully seal up the cooling system with the new head gasket. So unfortunately, this is probably engine time.
Okay, thanks, Mark. When you're talking about like the hybrid motors, Jim, how long do he has 150,000 miles? What can you expect to get on one of those?
You know, that that most of them do much better than that. I mean, although, again, if I go back to when I was a kid helping Dad with that head gasket on the Oldsmobile, nobody expected any of those cars to get to 100,000 miles, much less 150,000. But now, you know, I mean, starting in the late 80s, early 90s, car manufacturers started making vehicles that would go 300, 400, 500,000 miles. That's our expectation now. You know, it's like 150,000 miles. That's nothing. Mm-hmm. And while most Toyotas and Priuses and most other makes of cars and models will go quite a long distance, there are still, you know, failures of mechanical types or the bell-shaped curve. You get some at early mileage, you get some that go longer than you ever expect. That's a little earlier than we would like, but you know, most 2010 Priuses are going to get closer to 300,000 miles plus, but yeah, unfortunately there are going to be some that don't.
Sure. Okay, thanks. Next up is Joe, and he's in Cashton. Hi, Joe.
Hi. So my son has a 1974 Triumph Spitfire, and he put in a radio. It is a Bose radio, and it is it's a 200-watt radio, and he has 300-watt speakers. But when he turns up the radio, the speakers aren't very loud. He can put it almost all the way up to total volume, and there's not a lot of volume coming out of the speakers. Any ideas?
Well, that's more demand than any other device on the electrical system of that car was ever designed to really handle. I'm not sure how he has it wired. You know, you may have it wired into something in the dash or a fuse panel. If you're going to make that work successfully, you're going to be directly wiring to the battery. Make sure you've got it fused, because, yep, you're asking for a lot of power out of a 74 Spitfire's electrical system.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Jim Ward is our guest today. He is the service manager at Smart Motors. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at water features and answer your gardening questions, of course. That's tomorrow at 11. You can catch it again on Saturday morning at 6 or online anytime. Right now, we are talking about cars. So let's go right back to the phones. And we do have a line open if you want to call, 1-800-642-1234. But Bob in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob. Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm wondering if you could tell me how much use you can put on a spare tire that comes from the manufacturer.
Well, spare tires vary quite a bit anymore. It used to be that your spare tire was a full-size regular tire on a regular wheel, and that's often not the case. So the mini spares are going to have specific recommendations, and manufacturers vary a little bit on that, but they'll often say up to 50 miles an hour and up to 50 miles. They may be less mileage than that. That being said, I've seen people, because of budgets, run those tires for thousands of miles. Certainly not recommended, not a safe thing to do. Those tires don't have tread to deflect water and handle the car like a regular tire would. But obviously, the engineers manufacture them to do a bit more than whatever the minimum warning or whatever the maximum warning they're going to tell you is. But it, you know, once you get into that range, you're obviously in a risk. I mean, and honestly, there are cars now that don't even come with a spare. They come with a kit with a pump and a seal kit to seal it up. As some cars, just the more equipment and toys you put on cars, we lose space for things, and they sometimes get sacrificed. So there's actually new cars sold anymore that don't even have a spare at all. But the mini spares, you want to be careful and make sure that you know what the manufacturer's recommendation is. You might get a little past that, but the more you go beyond it, the more you're running a risk of either having a handling issue with the car or having damage. Those wheels are often a little smaller in diameter, and so some drive systems, particularly all-wheel drive systems, are kind of sensitive to that. You could do damage to other systems in the car, so it's pretty important to pay attention to what the manufacturer says that given spare is supposed to do for top speed and distance driven.
What's the easiest way to find out?
A lot of times the owner's manual is going to be the most obvious source. Although anymore you can Google a given year and model car and get an owner's manual online, so you don't necessarily have to have a paper manual in your hands. The one thing we don't necessarily want to do with tires is look on the sidewall, because the tire manufacturers don't always know what a given tire is going to be used for. If you look at the tires that you have that are on the road right now that aren't a spare, they will probably say something like maximum pressure of 45 pounds. That's probably at least 10 pounds higher than your manufacturer is going to say on the driver's door jamb. But yeah, when it comes to the spare tires, and sometimes even printed on the spare, often cars will have spare tire change instructions backed by the tire change tools. If you want to find some reference to tell you what the pressure is being, that's something you want to check regularly too, because that is a tire that has to have air in it. They will slowly leak down over time, and the last thing you want to do is have a flat tire and not have checked that spare in a few years to find out that your spare is flat too.
Yeah, that would be double bad news. Mark in New London, you are next. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Maybe a show or two before you were on last here, Jim, you were talking about four-cylinder engines and using oil. I have a 2009 Toyota Camry. It's four-cylinder, 140,000 miles on it. But I noticed that about every 1,500 miles, I may have to add a quart of oil. It doesn't appear to be burning oil or leaking oil. And I know you made some comments about that that issue to someone else that called in. And I was just calling in because I didn't write it down.
Yep. Well, the situation with that engine is that it probably is burning the oil. Burning oil is not going to produce smoke like they once did in cars. The emission systems are advanced enough. They'll burn that oil just as happily as they burn gas. And I don't mean in part of it in the engine, but also part of it in the exhaust system. The catalytic converters are made to, like a industrial factory's scrubber in the smokestacks, to clean up that hydrocarbon that didn't get burned in the engine. So we don't tend to see smoking on those vehicles. We don't tend to see the soot build up at the end of the tailpipe that we used to. That engine did have an issue with the pistons and the piston rings. They were countermeasured, in other words, redesigned to resolve that problem. But they did extend the warranties on them, I think, to like 10 years, 150,000 miles. But from what you're describing, it wouldn't have qualified for that, because what had to be done before that engine repair could be covered by the manufacturer was that we had to do an oil consumption test where we'd fill it up and then have you drive it 1,100 to 1,300 miles and come back in and check the oil level at that point. If it used more than a quart in that period of time, it will qualify for the new pistons and rings if it was within that period. If it used less than a quart in that time, then the conventional wisdom was that you just keep it full of oil. You learn how to check your oil, and you put oil in when it gets low. And that's at a quart to 1,500 miles, that's what the recommendation is going to be. Yes, it is burning some oil, and you can keep it filled up. The most important thing to keep in mind and realize about this is that quart to 1,500 miles that you've determined is in a normal daily commute that you do regularly. If you take this car on a trip and you drive out to the West Coast and do a long highway trip, that oil consumption under those circumstances can double or triple. So if you do take a trip in a car that you have comfortably and predictably learned uses a quart in 1,500 miles, start checking your gas on every fuel fill up at first to get a feel for what the increased oil consumption is on a long trip.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Next up is Wanda. She's in Waupaca. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Yeah, I got a question. First I got a story and then a question. I live in Waupaca County. We're right on the county line, with Sherrill Waupaca County line. This summer has been rain. We had so much rain that the road is got water that goes over it. It's probably about foot and a half, 2 feet high, and about 70 feet long, or that you drive through. I just bought a Nissan Murano, and ever since, because I got to go through it to go to my house in Waupaca County fixing it, but now my the detector that when you put your cruise control on, that'll slow up the car. It's a 2017. I bought it used. It's saying that it can't detect. And when that can't detect, I can't use my cruise control. Would being submerged all the time, would that rust that out? Would that break you know what I mean? Was
it does affect it. That? Yep, it does affect it. So what we're talking about here is a radar cruise control. This is a type of cruise control, a little different than conventional cruise control, that actually will control your speed. So you're going down the road, two lane, you know, like a divided highway, a two lane like an interstate. You may be in the left lane flying along, and up ahead of you, someone pulls out that's going slower than you do, and your vehicle will match the speed of that vehicle. So you don't have to brake, you don't have to touch anything. That vehicle makes the pass and pulls back in, nothing ahead of you, and then your vehicle all by itself will go back up to your set speed. Cool, really good stuff. But the sensors on the front of the car that do that, and these are often very similar to the collision prevention sensors that are on cars, are really sensitive to water. They're sensitive to water getting on them, possibly in them. Different manufacturers have had to redesign them because this is the technology that is just coming at us so fast that these are things that at one time things would be tested in the market for a few years before they were ever put out into our market. That's not so true anymore. These things get out there. So, you know, it definitely does affect it. It isn't so much probably a rust issue, and it may not be damaging that sensor, but it does prevent it from being able to work until it gets dried out again.
Okay. Thank you, Wanda. We did get an email from Jack, and he has a 2003 PT Cruiser that sets codes for oil pressure sensor voltage and power steering pump voltage. He says the car runs fine, but he's wondering, do these have anything in common, and what should he check?
Well, a lot of when we start getting voltage, and especially different system voltage warnings, that is often indication of a failing 12-volt battery. The 12-volt battery may still start the car fine, but and when you are driving the car, normally the alternator and the charging system produce the power it runs on, but there's so many demands on newer cars that the battery often has to kick in and operate some of those systems, and the testing is sometimes done while you're also starting the car. So it's one thing I would do is have the battery tested, even though it might start the car. Take a look at that. The other thing that can cause those kind of things are grounds. There's a lot of different circuits that may operate different systems but may share common ground. So I'm not sure where on an 03 PT Cruiser the ground for those would be, but either testing that battery or checking those grounds is where you want to start.
So they are basically connected, probably?
They're not necessarily directly connected in terms of from the power source to the device they operate, mm-hmm. but they may be connected on the ground side to where they have a common ground.
Great. Next, we're going to Terry. Terry's in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Terry.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I've got a 1996 motorhome Allegro with a 454 Chevy in it. Now, it keeps overheating no matter what I do to it. The only thing I haven't done is change the antifreeze.
So you've replaced the radiator, replaced the water pump, put a thermostat in it?
No, I haven't done the water pump or the radiator. I did a thermostat, and I went from 165 to 195. That didn't work.
Okay. Well, anytime we've got overheating, it basically we either aren't getting flow all the way through the system, the radiator. There are a number of possibilities here in that kind of a circumstance. Similar to the earlier overheating call, the cooling fan has to work right. I'm not sure on that motorhome if it's going to be an electric fan or if it's going to be like a fan clutch with it's driven by a belt, but it's got a hydraulic clutch that when the engine gets hot tells it to engage and pull in. You may see that fan turning, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's being driven. So that's, you've got to check and make sure that we're actually, that the system to push the air through that radiator at low speeds and it stops is doing it. Secondly, radiators themselves can get plugged up on the outside or on the inside. So the flow of the cooling system needs to be checked. The actual fins of the radiator need to be looked at. All those things check out. Then, are you experiencing any loss of coolant? Do you have to add fluid?
I don't have an experience any loss.
Yep. So we don't have a leak problem, so we don't necessarily have to go that way. But, yep, checking both the airflow on the outside and the liquid flow on the inside, you can have a water pump that the impeller, the actual little pump mechanism inside of it that actually spins and pushes the water through may not, might be slipping. It may not be spinning at the same speed as the pulley on the outside that's being driven by the engine. So all things that have to be checked. There's quite a variety of things that could give you the issues you're getting, but if we've only put a thermostat in it, we've got a long way to go on the checklist.
Okay, thanks, Terry. We've got another caller from Iowa. It's Bruce, and he's in Gutenberg. Hi, Bruce.
Say, I got a quick question. I have a Honda CRV with about 16,000 miles on it, and I've only changed the oil once. The owner's manual does not tell you when to change the oil, and mileage-wise, it just says the sensor will come on And I mean, I can go to that and it says I have 50% life yet in my oil. 16,000 miles and only one oil change. Is that correct?
Well, a lot of cars that use synthetic oil, modern vehicles, have a 10,000-mile oil change interval, and I have been very loath in my career to say that we need to do oil changes more often than the manufacturer recommends. But manufacturers are having to make a number of compromises to the cost of ownership of vehicles, and some of those compromises have to do with maintenance. And so I'm kind of slowly changing my thinking about these things because of some of the experiences and some of the things I've seen. You know, I've had customers with a 92 vehicle that they, you know, just maintained, you know, scrupulously kept it like showroom and got 450,000 miles out of it by just really, I mean, not that they didn't have to do some repairs, but by doing the minimum manufacturer recommended maintenance. Newer vehicles that have 10,000-mile oil change intervals and have no fluid interval changes for other systems like transmissions and driveline fluids, we're not going to see 450,000 miles out of those engines unless you do something more to them. So, you know, you can, in the systems that monitor the oil and tell you when you need to change it as opposed to just using a standard mileage, you know, the real question is how long do you want this engine to last? I mean, if your expectation is the expectation most of us have developed from the late 80s and early 90s that vehicles will go several hundred thousand miles, that's not going to happen with that kind of an oil change interval. It, you know, it may go 100, 150,000, but that there's going to be wear and there's going to be more fuel dilution in oil and more contaminants get in oil because of these longer intervals. So, you know, of all the things you can do on a car, oil changes are not terribly expensive. They usually don't take a terribly long time. That is one area where I encourage you to think about doing it more frequently.
Okay, so more is better.
It is.
Okay, thank you. Daniel emailed. He has a 2007 Ford Freestyle with a CVT transmission. Heard recently that this transmission has a poor track record. Any thoughts in the last minute, Jim?
Well, CVT transmissions, they have, you know, there's also something that's fairly an early. Early in their development, and this is a transmission that in a lot of ways is simpler than a regular automatic transmission, but they do use kind of a hybrid belt mechanism that there have been some wear issues with. You know, I would check on an 07. It's not likely that Ford's going to have any support programs with it anymore. And, you know, again, this is a transmission that typically most manufacturers didn't have fluid change recommendations, but you can do fluid changes on it, and that is what I'd recommend. If there isn't a Ford recommendation, and I'm not sure on that, you consider getting a fluid change and have them take a look at the condition of that fluid and see if it looks like, you know, they're getting metal contamination or issues that would indicate a problem.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Jim Ward. He's a service manager at Smart Motors, and we'll be back to take more car maintenance questions after this look at the news. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network today. I am Jill Nadeau. Vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward is back with us. He is the service manager at Smart Motors, and he has over 10 years of master certification, and he's here to answer your vehicle maintenance question. Has your car been giving you problems? Well, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our lines are filled right now, but before we get to those very patient people, Jim, we want to talk a little bit about when you're buying a used car, and earlier in the show we were talking about water damage. How do you know when you're buying this car that it hasn't been in a flood?
Well, unfortunately, just test driving the car or looking at the outside of the car, and you know, it may look perfect. And even looking at the interior may not tell you that. Every year, there are at least a couple hundred thousand to 300,000 cars that have been flood damaged that get reintroduced into the market. And places that work, that do these cars may have a whole fleet of cars to choose from. Some that, you know, all water damaged, some that had damaged engines but didn't have damaged interiors. And so they may mix and match and take an engine out of this car and take carpeting out of that car to make a saleable car and put it back in the market. And the car may look fine and it may drive fine, but if it's actually been in a flood, you can have, you know, ongoing mold issues. You can have corrosion issues that affect wiring, and just ongoing nightmares from a car like that. Most new car manufacturers want to protect their dealers, their new car dealers from buying those cars, because again, you can't easily just tell by, you know, cars are traded in, and you know, it's not an extensive inspection they do on that car when it's traded in. It's a quick look over that they do. Cars are bought at auction. It's very similar, you know, so it is easier than you'd think to end up as a dealer or as a private buyer ending up with a car like that. So manufacturers often have a bulletin that will show you, and these bulletins are surprisingly long, you know, a couple dozen pages of different types of inspections, and they'll, you know, talk about, you know, and what you've got to keep in mind is that a car may not just be sitting and have water come evenly level all the way up the car, the front end of the car only, the rear. But some of the most common things that we look for right away are inside the bottom of the front bumper and the rear bumper. Is there gravel and mud and stuff that's dried that's indicated that you know, even though they might have cleaned everything else up, that's an area that often traps some of that. If it's got a spare tire back in that spare tire well, underneath the spare, if you look at the very bottom of it, is there debris and stuff that looks like that there was water there once and it dried? If you look at the pedals, you know, fairly late model cars, less than 5 years old, typically are not going to have rust on the accelerator pedal and the brake pedal. But if that car's been submerged, interior's been wet, then it may have those conditions. But there are extensive inspections both under hood and throughout the vehicle, interior, exterior, and underneath, that are recommended to check for flooding. You know, one of the things that when you're buying a car, you just don't want to go by visual appearances. I mean, if you're buying cars from dealers, Carfax is often run to look at that car's history and see where it's been. That won't always tell the whole story, but you know, looking at those sources and having the car thoroughly inspected by someone who really knows what they're looking for flood situations is the best way to stay out of that trouble, because they are in the market. There are lots of them out there.
Okay, well, thanks for that information, Jim. Now we'll go back to the phone. Let's go to Jack. He's in Madison. Thanks for holding on, Jack. What can we help you with?
Yes, I was looking to ask a question about my car.
Go right ahead. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Jack.
My name is Dean.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think we just probably had a problem with that. But go ahead, Dean.
What can we do for you? What kind of car and what's the question?
Yes, I have a 2011 Crown Vic, and I had problems at about 38 miles an hour to about 41. It would start to chug, and it would kind of like hesitate, and I thought maybe it was a transmission problem, and I checked the transmission fluid. It was fine, and so I changed the throttle body out and cleaned it and put a new TPS, throttle body position sensor, mm-hmm. on it, and it helped. The idle started to be a little bit better, but it still did it. And so I've been putting in Chevron, Techron, fuel injector cleaner into it, and mm-hmm. it's gotten a lot better, and it only does it at 41 miles an hour. What would that possibly be?
It's interesting that the things you've done have affected it, but they haven't resolved it. You know, somewhere in your fuel system, you've got something sticking, either a fuel orifice that you may not be able to clean out entirely with fuel system cleaner. If you keep using it, eventually it may, but you know, it's going to come down probably to doing some pressure testing from point to point through the fuel system to find out, you know, where things are off, where something is sticking.
Okay. All right. Well, sorry about that confusion there, Dean. Apparently you called in the exact same time that Jack dropped off. So sorry about the confusion, but thanks for the call. Let's go next to Fred. He's in Shorewood. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
You know, if I'm going to keep a car a fair amount of years and the mileage is going to be very low every year, what about changing the oil twice a year instead of once a year?
I'd sleep better. You know, it's more expensive maintenance than it used to be. You know, oil change is more expensive than it used to be, but still it's fairly cheap maintenance. If you plan to keep the car for a long time, you know, particularly low mileage cars often don't get driven enough. You know, low mileage can mean different things. It can mean either that you don't drive it every day and do really long drives occasionally, or that you do drive it every day and drive really short distances. But either way is not good for the inside of an engine. Condensation builds up, particularly in our climate, with cold to heat temperatures. So I would recommend doing that twice a year.
Okay. Thanks, Fred. Next, we have Peter, and he's a truck driver passing through Wisconsin. What can we help you with, Peter?
Oh, yeah. I got a I'm thinking about buying a Porsche, and I just wonder how reliable they are. It's got a diesel engine in it, and how good that they will start up in the wintertime, and how good are the bodies are like for rusting out.
Well, Porsche vehicles are. I don't want to knock that car because it's a definitely a performance vehicle that many of us. I worked at a Porsche dealer one time, and ultimately the idea of having a career 911 is kind of a dream. But you know that's not a car that's necessarily known for reliability. You know, not necessarily rust through problems, but you know they are expensive to fix. And you know it depends greatly on the year and model that you're talking about. I mean, we can go back, you know, to late 70s, early 80s, and some models of Porsche 914s weren't much different than a Volkswagen Karmann Ghia. Other models are very sophisticated, and but you know, again, I'm not going to say that it's a vehicle that typically breaks down, but reliability is not the reason that you buy a performance car like that.
Okay, well, do some research, Peter, and drive safe. Next, we've got Mitchell in Viroqua. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a 2007 Silverado LTZ with 210,000 miles on it. And when I'm driving it, like, through town, when I hit, like, 30 miles an hour, I'm just coasting. My traction control light can come on. It's not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, if you stop with the traction control light on, the shift from first to second is rough. Like, throw your head back into your seat rough.
Mm.
And if that light's not on, it shifts like a dream still. I was just wondering what, if you've seen that before.
That the traction control system can be monitored electronically while you're driving. You have to have a scan tool hooked up to it and watch what the sensors are doing. Ultimately, when it comes on, either a sensor isn't operating as it's supposed to, or it's saying that something is happening that isn't really happening, that a wheel is spinning and or skidding, because of the type of sensors that the traction control uses are the same as the anti-lock brakes. So one of those sensors is probably not sending the right signal, and that's causing the traction control system then to send signals to the engine and transmission computers telling them that I can't control things the way I'm supposed to. You're going to have to go into a special mode, and then your transmission may not shift right. But I would start by having those sensors tested with a scanner while it's being driven to see, you know, unfortunately, you have to catch it red-handed doing it. And you mentioned it doesn't do it every time, but that would be the way to get to the bottom of that.
Okay, thank you, Mitchell. We have a line open if you've got a question for Jim. He's the service man, or the service manager. I didn't give you a promotion or anything at Smart Motors, and you can give us a call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, we did get a call or an email from Mark. He's got a 2016 Toyota RAV4. It needed a water plug pump replacement due to a small leak, and he thinks this seems pretty premature at just 37,000 miles, and he doesn't see a service bulletin out on it to address it. Should he expect to replace this again at 60?
Not necessarily, and leakage from the water pump is not necessarily an indication that pump should be replaced. There are different types of water pumps that use different types of internal seals, but most water pumps have what's called a weep hole on them, and there is some fluid that may occasionally come out of there, and you typically, when a technician's looking at it, he may not see liquid coolant itself, but once the liquid dries, it leaves kind of a powdery deposit there, and that powdery deposit can build up over time. Different manufacturers over time have dealt with that different ways. We used to work on Volvos, and they had an issue like that, and they changed their water pump, and they added a little couple inch by couple inch shelf underneath that weep hole that would allow the fluid to build up and evaporate from there, and that would contain the powdery stuff, and it just wouldn't appear that something was leaking. So Toyota actually does have a bulletin, and although it probably is an older bulletin that says it applies to like 2007 to 2014 vehicles, it really applies to all of them, that really says that, you know, this depending on what you see. You really should catch the water pump leaking and having liquid there and not just a deposit buildup. So it, one thing that's possible is that the water pump may certainly have failed on a 16. It sounds a little early. It is possible it did, and it isn't necessarily something you should expect replacing that frequently, but it is also possible that a technician looked at that and saw what he wouldn't anticipate on another vehicle, but didn't necessarily indicate that your water pump needed to be replaced. So when it comes to given manufacturers, they often have special recommendations for evaluating certain components, and that's one of them. And Toyota water pumps are something that there's kind of special evaluation recommendations. So just the fact that it leaks at all is not necessarily an indication that the pump has failed.
Okay. And next, we'll go back to the phones. Derek from Cashton is up. Hi, Derek.
Hi, how's it going?
What? Great. Go ahead.
I'm looking at a 14 EcoDiesel, the Ram 1500. I was wondering what to watch for, how are they for reliability, stuff like that.
You know, modern diesels run cleaner than they ever have, more dependable than they've ever been. But one of the things that they have is an emission system that uses a urea fluid that gets injected to help clean up that exhaust. And those systems have been pretty problematic for some manufacturers with check engine lights coming on, and they've had to redesign some components for them. So, that is the one area that is kind of a drawback on those diesels. But otherwise, they're great.
Okay. Thanks, Derek. Ted in West Dallas, you're next.
Hey, I got a question for you. I've been looking at replacing a 20-year-old car, or truck rather, and I found on a lot a 2018 never-titled Volkswagen Golf, and it's a pretty... it's a pretty good price, but then in the back of my mind, I'm going, why has this thing never been sold and titled if it's a 2018, and the 2020s are, going to be coming out pretty soon. A couple of things that you, touched on was things like, flood damage, and I'm thinking, well, how do I know where this vehicle, originated? Are there things I should be looking for? I mean...
Is this vehicle is at a Volkswagen dealer?
Yes, it's never been titled, and it's been they say it's been on their lot since the inception, but who knows?
Well, they should be able to show you proof of that. I mean, that's all stuff that they can go to a manufacturer's Volkswagen site and show that they were the original purchasing dealer, show the date that they got it. And, it's possible that it just didn't sell for one reason or another. Volkswagen took quite a hit with their reputation with the diesel scandal that they had. And, the first dealership I worked at was a Porsche Audi Volkswagen dealership. So I've got kind of a soft place in my heart for them. And, I would start with a conversation with that dealer to look for something other than someone's word, because they should be able to produce that to show you the documentation of that car's origin and history.
Okay, thanks, Ted. You can get a pretty good deal when you buy a car that's been on the floor for a while, can't you?
You should.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay, Adam in Fond du Lac, you're next. What can we help you with?
Hi. I just had a quick question. I have a 2003 Toyota Matrix with 198,000 miles on it. When I am at like a stoplight and I have it in drive, it vibrates. I was just wondering if that could be a engine mount or possibly something to do with the transmission.
So this vibration, can you hear it or do you simply feel it?
You can feel it and hear it.
Noises are. I'm thinking of examples of different times that we've looked for noises. One of the most innocuous things that turned out to be causing a noise that we chased for a while was actually the hood on a car. The hood has got rubber stops on it that actually kind of screw in and out. You can turn them and make them shorter, and turn them the other way and make them taller. And sometimes those things will compress, or from vibration will kind of screw in. And just something as simple as the hood tension with those stoppers not being right will produce a vibration you can feel and hear, and can drive you nuts looking for the source of it. It is just noises are often not where they sound like they're coming from, but it is a matter of of elimination. You know, you just when it comes to vibration, you know, if it had an engine misfire or something, I'd expect to have a check engine light on. So this is probably more something mechanical. It could have to do with how the engine's mounted. If it's ever had to have the engine taken in and out, the cradle or the framing that the engine sits in, if that gets off center just a little bit, it can cause a vibration. So the range of things that can cause that symptom is just huge. And you know, basically, you have to start picking off in a process of elimination to try to track down where it's coming from.
Okay, good luck, Adam. Derek in Madison, you're next. What can we help you with?
Good afternoon. First, I want to say I had a great relationship with my service at your dealership with my wife's Camry, so I'm very pleased with that. Now we're looking for another used car for our family and thinking about a 2012 Outback four-cylinder or a 2011 Venza four-cylinder. Wondering if Subaru got the dreaded head gasket issue solved, and if you have any thoughts about reliability of front-wheel drive versus all-wheel drive models where they're both available.
The drive systems in both of those vehicles are you know, Toyotas and Subarus are pretty superior, pretty dependable. The Outback did have some head gasket and some oil leakage issues, which I can't say that I've seen, you know, completely resolved on them. I mean, the good vehicles are fantastic, you know, for Wisconsin winters, and they are fairly dependable. I think you tend to see a little bit more of an uptick on those kind of driveline repairs on a Subaru engine in terms of oil leaks and stuff than you do generally on a Toyota. I mean, you know, of course, obviously I can't claim to be unbiased on that, but my own niece drives a Subaru, and you know, I've seen her experiences with it, and that's one vehicle. But we work very near a Subaru dealer and talk to those guys regularly. So, yep, I think either vehicle, the drivetrain is going to get you around great in the winter. But yeah, I would have a few more concerns. If I was looking at buying one, I probably would be thinking about at least taking out a powertrain service contract to protect you a bit.
Okay. And let's go to Max in Oregon. Hi, Max.
I have a 2011 Volkswagen Golf. It's a standard 5-speed with a 2.5-liter five-cylinder engine. And I had to replace the flywheel at something like 70,000 miles, which seemed early to me. And I was wondering if there was any truth to the myth that hanging on to the shifter while you're driving, relaxing your hand on the shifter, would somehow wear out the flywheel or the clutch or any of the mechanisms that would cause me to have to replace that flywheel earlier. If that's one of the problems that might have contributed to an early replacement, you know, it'd be sort of like riding the clutch if you're,
sure,
or using the clutch as a brake while you're on a hill.
Well, with the shifter and with the clutch, there's some bad habits that don't usually lead to much of anything, but you know, typically holding the clutch pedal in extended periods of time, the idea is to shift it neutral and get the clutch pedal back out. With the shifter, holding onto that shifter can cause some wear, but it's usually not to the flywheel that wear is going to occur. It's going to be, you know, more in the relationship between the gear and the synchronizers and that kind of thing. What were the, was the flywheel replaced with a clutch replacement at that time?
I think it was just the flywheel that was replaced. The you know, sort of where the clutch engages with the engine, and I was told that it had something to do with, like you said, the synchronization, because in a Volkswagen reverses over and up it's over to the left and up, as opposed to
right. Usually Volkswagen shift linkage is kind of a backwards throw, I mean, the way they do it. But I mean, it is unusual to replace a flywheel at 70,000 miles. Most often, if that's done, it's done because a clutch failed. I'm not sure what the symptoms were from this, but that it doesn't sound like a typical failure. I'm not sure what happened there. Any given part can be mismanufactured and have an issue, which unfortunately isn't under warranty forever. They're under warranty usually, you know, 5-6 years, 50-60,000 miles. So don't have enough information here really to determine why that happened, but it's not a common scenario. And but I wouldn't expect to have to replace it that often.
Okay, just a little bit of time left, but let's take an email from John in La Crosse. He's a late model Volvo, and the maintenance recommendations include changing the brake fluid every 40,000 miles. He's wondering if that's something that's really necessary, and if so, why?
There are tests. Brake fluid is a hydroscopic oil, and what that means is it absorbs moisture. You don't want to have a brake system. It breaks your hydraulic, so when you push on your pedal, that fluid is helped with a vacuum booster and a master cylinder that has to create a lot of pressure at the wheel, at the brake, to make it stop the car. And so you don't want to have a water bubble being able to block that system somewhere. So hydroscopic fluids break the water up and kind of absorb it. And ultimately, you change that fluid because of that exposure to it over time. So I would stick with that recommendation. I do think it's a good idea to get the fluid out of there, particularly in this climate.
Okay, great. We've been talking with Jim Ward. He's the service manager at Smart Motors, and he'll be back with us on October 17th. Garden Talk is tomorrow. Hope you can be with us. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network.